So good afternoon. The focus of my talk this afternoon will be perception. And I'd like to start off with a story that was given to me by one of my Sangha members several years ago, which I think really relates to this subject so clearly. And it's a story about a young couple that moved into a new house. And the first morning as they were sitting eating breakfast, they were looking across the street to their neighbor who was putting out her laundry. And the young woman said to the man, "Boy, she really doesn't know how to do her laundry. Look how dirty her clothes are." And the husband didn't say anything. Well, for the next month, every time they were sitting there and watching the woman put out her laundry, the woman said again, "She just doesn't know how to do this. Maybe she's using the wrong detergent." And the husband would say nothing. One morning, as they were sitting eating breakfast, looking across, she exclaimed with surprise how clean the neighbor's laundry had become. She said, "She's obviously figured out how to do the washing. I wonder who taught her." The husband smiled at that point and said, "I got up early this morning and cleaned the window." And so it is with life. What we see depends on the purity of the window through which we look. So the focus of my talk is perception. But I'd like to start off by asking you to close your eyes and just go inside and take a few moments to reflect on the purpose of your practice. Both being here these next few days, but your practice in general. Why am I doing this? For some of you, it might be to learn how to be calmer, less reactive, maybe to cope with pain more effectively, or stress, or deal with some psychological problem. I would suggest, however, and you can open your eyes now, that if the ultimate purpose of your practice is not to experience the truth of life as it is, your practice is off the mark. So what does that mean to see the truth of life? To see life as it is, not as I think it is, not as I want it to be, but life as it is. Remember that one of the practices that we're going to be engaging in this retreat is something called Vipassana. And that's an ancient Pali word, but when you translate it into English, the most common translation is to see clearly. To see life as it is. But this isn't just a Eastern thing. In the Bible, in the New Testament, John quotes Jesus as saying, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." So truth, or I might also call it non-dual reality, is not something that can be known by the cognitive mind. Zen master Huang Po said this, "Those that seek the truth by means of intellect and learning only get further and further away from it. Not till you abandon your thoughts, cease their branching here and there, not till you abandon all thoughts of seeking for something, not till your mind is motionless as wood or stone, will you be on the right road to the gate." Now, he's using language that Daryl referred to earlier in terms of road or gate, but it's just a metaphor for the unfolding of our practice. What he's saying is you can't think your way into the truth. When you're not lost in your thoughts, however, truth is always here for you, right here, right now. Zen Master Dogen stated this so clearly at one point when he said, "If you can't find the truth right where you are, where do you expect to find it? You don't need to go off to a cave in Tibet. The truth is always here, always now, if you can open your eyes and see what's truly unfolding." To experience the truth, we must see things as they are, which is not so easy because of all the things that distort our perception. Truth remains once we are no longer identified with, for example, our beliefs. There is a God. There isn't a God. Life is sacred. Life is cheap. There is reincarnation. At the end of life, the body dies, that's it. Those are beliefs people have. We have ideologies about what's right or wrong. It's going to be coming up very clearly as the election approaches. Who's got the right ideas? Is it the conservatives or the New Democrats or the Bloc or the Green Party? We get identified with our self-constructs. My gender, this is who I am. I'm a male or I'm a female. With my body, with my intellect, with my education, my clarity. Or as I've often seen, we can get identified with our confusion. Our work, some capacity that we have, for example, athletics. Our perceptions of what is valuable or not valuable. What is beautiful, what is important. We have so many mental overlays that there is a self, and this self is separate from the rest of life. Or the stories we have about our past or our future. As Daryl said this morning, the mind is constantly making up stories about our experience. And then, of course, what happens is we get lost in the story, missing the experience totally. These are all examples of filters, I would suggest, that can distort our perception. Therefore, being aware of and not identified with our perceptions is important in helping us experience the truth. So what is perception? Perception is one of the five aggregates. The Buddha divided this psychophysical organism into five, he called them aggregates, that's one of the translation, kinds of stuff is another one that is, and I kind of like it because it's really down to earth. So what are these five kinds of stuff that make up a human being? Well, first we have our physical form, the body with its five senses. Then on the mental side, the Buddha divided mind stuff into four categories: feelings, perception, what I'm talking about, mental formations, and consciousness. Now, mental formations is kind of a blanket term that covers the intellectual, emotive, and volitional aspects of mind. And consciousness is kind of like the motion detector that knows what's going on. So when there's a sight, there's seeing consciousness. And when there's a sound, there's hearing consciousness. These five aggregates make up what we call a human being. Now, I talked about the mental formations. There are 52 mental formations, according to the Buddha. And since his time, no one has been able to dispute that there's maybe 54 or 51. It seems that that's been fairly consistent. The Buddha, for me, is just the world's greatest psychologist because he had this capacity to look at the mind and really see clearly what was going on, and then was willing to share it with us so we have the benefit of his investigation. So there are these 52 mental factors, but the Buddha pulled out feeling and perception from this grouping of 52 for extra attention. Now, in my experience in reading what the Buddha has taught, he didn't kind of do things frivolously. So if he said, you want to pay attention to these, that means it's important. And so I want to give some attention to perception. Perception is the capacity of the mind to identify the distinctive marks of an object, and it is closely associated with the faculty of memory. And it arises in each moment of sense contact. Now, what does that mean? When we have a sense object, a sound, and a sense organ, an ear that's functioning, and sense consciousness, when those three things come together, we have a moment of sense contact. So in each millisecond of our life, we're having moments of sense contact. There's sights, there's sounds, there's tastes, there's physical sensations, there's mental events. So all of that is sense contact. And by the way, the mind is considered to be the sixth sense organ. So eyes see, ears hear, minds think and emote. So think of it that way. All three components have to be there for sense contact to happen. And it's really, you might say, wasn't that obvious? Well, have you ever had the experience where you were at home alone, engrossed in a book? So there was a sense object, the book. There was a sense organ, your eyes. There was sense consciousness, seeing consciousness. So you were totally there with the book. Your partner or your child comes home. They're making noise. You have a functioning ear. So there is a sense organ. There is a sense object, the sound. But the sense, there's no hearing consciousness there. Suddenly the person comes into the room and you're startled. Because in that moment, then the hearing consciousness is there, and there's a moment of sense contact in terms of hearing. So is that at least making sense? Okay. So in each moment of contact, there is also a feeling. Feeling is the quality of sense experience as being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So in each moment, we're having a sight, a sound, a smell, and in each moment of those experiences, we're experiencing the sight as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So I hear the bird behind me, and it's for me, it's a pleasant sound. So there's a pleasant feeling that arises. If someone were to run their fingernails over the blackboard back there, that would probably be an unpleasant feeling. Okay, an unpleasant hearing. The sense contact would be hearing, and the feeling that would be associated with that would be unpleasant. If I hear a weather report for a place that I'm never going to visit, then that would be a neutral feeling, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And it's important to be aware of these qualities of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral because the mind reacts to each one of these in a different way. That's one of the reasons why the Buddha singled feeling out for extra attention, because we want to be aware of how this unfolds. Coming back to perception. Perception names, identifies, classifies, discriminates, and categorizes our experience. And by doing so, it allows perception the next time some form, sound, odor, or sight comes to consciousness, that we can recognize that for what it is. So when I hear a sound, it's just vibrations hitting the eardrum. But perception recognizes that as bird or fire alarm or fan, whatever is going on. So that's how perception works. The most common and significant misperception that prevents us from seeing life as it truly is the perception that there is something called a self, an I. That there is something called a self that persists unchanging over time, that inhabits the body, that makes decisions about what I'm going to do, that was born and will eventually die. That's the misperception that 99.99% of the world have. And I'm going to suggest it is a misperception, because I'm going to suggest that when you start to experience the ultimate truth of the way things are, you will see that who you really are has never been born and will never die. Now, on Wednesday, I'm going to speak more to this misperception. Today, I'd like to explore perception in general and really kind of bring to consciousness why the Buddha singled it out for particular attention amongst all these 52 mental factors. Our linguistic ability is closely tied to perception. It's language that helps us form our ideas or points of view. And then we strongly identify with our perception. So this is my point of view. This is my idea. This is what I meant. When we strongly identify with our perceptions, we do not see things as they really are. And the Buddha referred to this as clinging to our views and opinions. Reflect on all the suffering that has occurred both now and in the past, in the world, as a consequence of people, groups, and countries clinging to their perceptions. I'll give you some examples, going from the individual to kind of the larger context. When I was still doing individual therapy, I had a client. I'd been working with her for some time. She worked at a company where she'd been there 9 years, but she was the lowest on the seniority list in her particular department. And one day she came in for her therapy session. I was seeing her, I think, about every 2 weeks, very distraught. And she informed me that the company was downsizing, and because she was the lowest on the seniority list, her job was going to be terminated. And then she proceeded to share with me all that that meant, what her perception of that experience was. First of all, she was probably going to have to sell her house and move to a bigger city because she wouldn't find a job in her area. She'd be missing her friends. She might not even get the same kind of job. And I would invite her to see that that maybe was just her perception and it might not happen. She wouldn't have anything of it. For basically the roughly 3 months from the time she told me that the position was going to be terminated until it actually occurred, and as I said, I was seeing her about every second week, a good portion of our discussion was on the consequences of her being identified strongly with this perception. Well, the day finally came, her job was terminated. I saw her about a week or 2 weeks later, and she came in and she had a look on her face that I perceived rightly or wrongly as being a little sheepish. And I said, well, and she said, you were right. And I said, what do you mean? She said, losing my job, getting it terminated, was the best thing that ever happened to me. She said, I've been rehired on as contract. I'm getting more money. I have much more flexibility. This was wonderful. And in that moment, she saw the suffering that had occurred to her as a consequence of her being attached to this perception, this view or opinion about what being fired meant. A lot of my students, when they start the mindfulness-based stress reduction program, are identified with the perception of themselves as being a loser or unlovable. It's pretty common in our culture. And there's a huge amount of suffering that follows from that. That's on an individual level. What on a group level? I could choose many things, but I'll narrow it down to just the challenges or the suffering that occurs when religious orientations become identified with. Going back historically, the Crusades and the Inquisition with the Catholic Church and Muslims. Or more recently in Northern Ireland, the conflict between the Protestants and the Catholics. Or right now in parts of the Middle East, the conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis. It's amazing. They're actually, on some level, I've lived in Saudi Arabia for 3 years and I've practiced and lived in Islamic countries. The difference between the two perceptions is not so great. And yet when people get identified with their perception and hold on to it and won't shift, we know the suffering that follows. On a more global level, there's a perception that Mr. Putin has about where Crimea belongs. And of course, it's different from the perception that NATO would have. And yet, those wonderful pictures that we've received from the astronauts looking down at Earth, I don't see any border on the Crimea as being part of Russia or somewhere else. That's just an arbitrary perception, and now there's fighting over it. So perception is important. Clinging to our perception is what gets us into difficulty. At one point, the Buddha said, those who are attached to their views and opinions go around the world annoying people. You might have noticed that. Our perceptions are not permanent and unchanging, because life is constantly changing. They change with the state of our emotions. Just reflect on your experience when it's in the middle of winter and you're in a really good mood and it starts to snow heavily. For me, that's usually a pretty positive experience. Yet if I was in a maybe a low mood, a bad mood, the same experience, the snow coming down, so I got to clean it, now I got to, you know, how am I going to get to work and all that stuff, the perception changed with the changing circumstance, the changing mood, I should say. It also changes, our perceptions change with our changing circumstances. Let's say my wife and I have moved into a little two-bedroom house. It's totally adequate for us. But 5 years later, if we have two children, the house is no longer adequate. The house did not change. My perception of the house changed. There's a story from my family that illustrates how perception can also change with understanding. My mother was a city girl. Born and raised in Toronto, all her life, had not gone very far beyond the greater Toronto area. But my father was born in the north. And so, as the story goes, when they were on their honeymoon, he took her north to a fishing camp. And one night during that period of time, my mother woke my father up saying, "Larry, there's a woman screaming on the other side of the lake." The feeling she had from that sense contact was quite unpleasant. And of course, my father rolled over, heard the sound, and said, "That's a loon." Suddenly, my mother's understanding changed, her perception of the sound changed. What was then had been an unpleasant feeling suddenly became a pleasant feeling. And for the rest of my mom's life, I remember she would always love the sound of a loon. So perceptions are changing because everything else is changing. Therefore, it's not possible to hold on to perceptions as being permanent or mine without coming to some difficulty. When perception arises without mindfulness, we tend to only see the surface appearance of things and to not truly understand its nature. Joseph Goldstein tells a wonderful story about this superficial perception without mindfulness, and it relates to the son of one of his friends, who was about 6 or 7 years old. They were in the classroom, and the teacher was talking to them about apples and asking them about the different colors of apples. So some of the kids said apples are red, and others said they're green. Others said they're yellow or golden. But this one child said, "Apples are white." So the teacher said, no. You know that we have red apples and golden apples and green apples, but there's no white apples. Well, the child wouldn't budge. And there was some degree of conflict until at one point the child said, "What happens when you cut open an apple?" The teacher at that point got it. The teacher's perception had just been superficial, where for some reason the child had looked beyond the superficial and seen truly what was happening. Superficial perceptions without mindfulness cannot penetrate experience to realize their impermanent and unsubstantial nature. It's like when we see a movie, if we're at the theater. What we see is people moving across the screen, seemingly solid. Yet what we understand is that these are individual frames of film moving past the lens. But they're doing it so quickly that we don't see that. What we see is this continuous flow. So that's perception without mindfulness. Also, if we have, let's say, a torch or a flashlight, and I'm swinging it around very quickly, our perception would be that there's a ring of light there. But of course, reality is, it's just that it's going so quickly that we don't see the individual moments where there's light here, light here, light there. So perception with mindfulness is like steadying a magnifying glass so we can see clearly. Perception frames the experience for a more in-depth mindful investigation of what's going on. Another reason that we cannot see the impermanent nature of things is that we tend to look at things from a distance. Now, actually, I meant to look across the river to see if this is true, but let's say there's a mountain. I know there is a mountain there, but let's say it looks like just a solid grouping of green when you look at it from a distance. If you got closer to it, you might see the individual trees. If you got closer still, you might see the leaves and the branches. If you really got close to it and had an electron microscope, what you would see is nothing more than an ever-changing energy field. It's only because we're perceiving things from a distance that we don't see the true nature of what is actually arising. So perception without mindfulness is like looking from a distance. Mindfulness enables us to refine our attention so we can penetrate beyond the surface level of things to see the insubstantial and impermanent nature of all of life's experience. Each of us lives in a mind-created universe, and no two universes are the same. The worldview of a physician would be very different than a worldview of an architect or a lawyer or a business person. Whatever we strongly identify with is what we notice in the world. So if we identify with our bodies, then that's what we see when we look at other people. We compare our bodies, feeling either better or worse depending on who we're comparing our bodies to. If we identify with our intellect, when we meet someone, we compare ourselves to their intelligence. How many degrees do they have? Often people identify with their wealth, and that's what they look at. How much money does he have? What kind of house does he live in? Or it could be athletic ability. No two people have the same perceptions. There is enough kind of common agreement amongst our perceptions that we can have a superficial agreement that things are the way they are. But in truth, each of us lives in a separate world, formed mostly by our preconceptions. And these perceptions color our feelings whenever we encounter a sense object. So no two people feel the same about anything. In fact, no two people see the same things. When you die, your world will die with you. Kind of interesting when you think about it. The idea or construct of self is reinforced through this concept of time. Because of memories and the capacity to project into the future, we believe that we've lived before and that we will continue to exist in this idea called time. But time has no objective existence. If we look at a clock, we believe that it's measuring time. Well, chronologically, that's true. But time, as I'm speaking about it, is a mental construct. Time that refers to past, present, or future. Our past is nothing but memory. Without a memory, we would have no past. We imagine that certain things happen to us, but the us that it happened to, in other words, the physical sensations, the feelings, the perceptions, the thoughts and consciousness, all arise and pass with the experience. Isn't it true? Well, someone might say, yes, but this happened to me. Then that means that the understanding is intellectual. It's not a true insight. Because of our identification with our perception of a past self, me, as if it were more than a mental construct, many of us carry around a heavy psychological burden of being a survivor of abuse or a victim of some circumstance. These ideas are nothing more than the mind's perceptions. But the past does seem so real. Memories and images and the delusion of a self that existed in the past create a convincing drama when it arises in the mind. So we need to be present when these memories arise in the mind and let them arise and pass away without reinforcing them by either clinging to them or pushing them away. Alan Watts has stated that memory is the corpse of an experience from which the life has vanished. That really, for me, puts it into context. Memory is the corpse of an experience from which the life has vanished. Nothing ever happened to you. Because what can happen to a concept or an image? A victim is someone who gives more credence to thoughts about the past than to what is happening in the present moment. This is not my statement. This is from my teacher, but this has been so helpful for me. A victim is someone who gives more credence to thoughts about the past than to what is actually happening in the present moment. Now, it's understandable because there are some things that reinforce this victim stance. A common belief that many of my students have is that by holding on to this, I'm going to prevent it from happening again, whatever the disrespectful or abusive experience was. Or I have a sense of my own self-importance from having been able to survive this. Or it might be that I get sympathy as a consequence of this. We cannot let go of our past piecemeal. When we see that it is nothing but a story in the mind, and that's it, the past completely falls away on its own. Just think about it for a few moments. What is my past? Can you show me your past? The only thing that you have that is the past is a thought that could be arising in the moment right now. That's your past. That, identifying with that as being some kind of truth that's happening now, that's what gets us into difficulty. So that's the past. But what about the future? The future is the sum total of both our desires and fears. We all have a desire that our life will unfold in a certain way so that we might kind of live happily ever after. We all have that. But we also have fears, because we know eventually the body is going to get old, it's going to get sick, and it's going to die. So we're really stuck with this psychological dilemma of kind of having desires about the future and then fear. However, the future is nothing but thoughts. If we had no desires to which we were attached and no fears about what might or could happen, we would have no future. But someone might say, yes, but what happens if I'm not prepared? When you live from presence, what this retreat is about, there is faith or trust that life, which is manifesting as you, will make an appropriate choice to deal with what's arising. This is one of the real benefits from presence. We no longer have to carry the past. There is no future. There is just this right here, right now, which we can experience from presence and trust that that's all we need to do. We need to remember, however, that the present moment is not the space between the past and the future. How could a real moment exist between two non-existent points in time? If the past and the future don't exist, then the present moment, as I've just described it, can't exist either. The true present moment is outside of time. In the teachings of Solomon, it states, eternity is not time without end, but an ending of time. So the greatest enemy of the mind is the true present moment, because our minds are always fighting it because they can only live in terms of thoughts of the past and thoughts of the future. When we're no longer identified with these thoughts, we live in the true present moment, which is out of time. The Buddha acknowledges at one point when he said, let go of the past, let go of the future, let go of the present, and cross over to the farther shore of existence. With mind wholly liberated, you should come no more to birth and death. So what we want to do is experience life from a beginner's mind. So what is that? You've all had beginner's mind. You've seen beginner's mind, for those of you, for example, who are parents. If you've seen a three-year-old discover a flower for the first time, they're really absorbed in it. They're looking at the stamen and the, I'm not, I'm organically or biologically challenged with the pestle and the leaves and all that stuff. But we as experts go by and say, oh, that's just a rose. So beginner's mind is there, but we tend to have lost our beginner's mind. But we can recultivate it. And it's important because, as Zen Master Suzuki Roshi said, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. So we want to have this mind that really can respond with lots of flexibility, and that requires a beginner's mind. So how do we cultivate beginner's mind? Well, there's a story from the Zen tradition about a professor that was been reading a lot about Zen. And finally he decided he wanted to go and interview a Zen master to kind of share his understanding. So he made an appointment with the Zen master, arrived at the Zen master's house, and as would be the tradition in Zen, the Zen master invited the professor for tea. So the professor sat down, and rather than paying attention to the Zen master doing the tea ceremony, which is quite elaborate and a meditation in itself, the professor started to talk about this about Zen and that about Zen. Meanwhile, the Zen master just made the tea. Finally, when it was done, he turned to the professor, asked him to hold out his cup. So he held out his cup, and the Zen master started to pour the tea. When it filled up to the top of the cup and started to flow over the side, the Zen master continued to pour. At which point, the professor said, "Stop, stop, can't you see this cup is full? There's no room for any more." At that point, the Zen master stopped pouring and said, "Just like this cup, you're so full of your own views and opinions, there's no room for new understanding. If you hope to experience the truth, you must first empty your mind. Empty your mind of all your beliefs, your perceptions, all your conditioning." That's really the challenge. There was a 20th century Buddhist Taoist philosopher who went by the pen name of Wei Wu Wei. And he offered the following poem or teaching on the cultivation of beginner's mind, which I'll share with you. And I'll say it slowly. It is complex. You don't have to remember it all. But just to get maybe the general flavor of what we do when we're going to do some a meditation practice called cultivating beginner's mind. Cease listening to what is being heard. Listen to what is hearing instead. Then listening will become what is hearing, and hearing will be what is heard. Cease looking at what is being seen. Look at what is seeing instead. Then looking will become what is seeing, and seeing will be what is seen. Cease seeking the sought of the seeker. Seek what is seeking instead. Then seeking will become what is searching, and the searching will be what is sought. Leave sound unheard, and hearing hear instead. For hearing lives, but sound as such is dead. So I'm not going to ask you, I don't want the mind to get all kind of revved up on that one, because the actual practice is not so difficult. So we're going to practice a meditation this afternoon that helps us recognize the ephemeral and subjective nature of perceptions. The idea behind the practice is to recognize that perceptions that arise in the mind do not belong to a self, and in fact, by identifying with what is perceived, that's what keeps us in a state of delusion. So don't be fooled by the apparent simplicity of this meditation. Identifying with this delusion of self is the only thing that keeps us from experiencing our inherent freedom. You can do this meditation both when you're walking and you're sitting. So the practice is called cultivating beginner's mind. We tend to identify with our perceptions as they arise to consciousness, and so they give us a sense of self, which prevents us from seeing things as they truly are. So we want to be able to respond to life from a beginner's mind, a mind that no longer reacts to what's occurring based on our past perceptions of experiences, but responds instead from a place of silence or presence. So We have a few minutes still before the walking period, so close your eyes and I'll give you the instructions. So settling into the body with the breath. Now, this first one really relates to when you are walking outside with your eyes open, but you can also think of this in terms of what you see the mind projecting as well. So instead of seeing with the eyes, see through the eyes as if you are looking through a window. In other words, detach from an I, meaning a me, when I say I, not E-Y-E, but an I that sees, and just connect with seeing. Instead of hearing with the ears, hear through the ears as if you were hearing through a speaker. In other words, detach from the eye that hears and just connect with hearing. Instead of thinking with the mind, think through the mind as if you were using a computer which is running a program. The thinking is just like the software of the program. Just connect with thinking. Because all that's arising is just seeing, hearing, thinking, but no one who is doing it. In other words, directly experience life through the body and mind without identifying with be the one who sees, hears, thinks, and so forth. It's to experience life without selfing, adding a self to the experience. When we do this, it collapses what is called the subject-object duality, that I'm a subject here that is separate from what's going on over there. All we realize when we do this is all there is the experience. So let me repeat it one more time. So instead of seeing through the eyes, instead of seeing with the eyes, see through the eyes as if you are looking through a window. In other words, detach from an I, a me, that sees and just connect with seeing. Instead of hearing with the ears, hear through the ears as if you were hearing through a speaker. In other words, detach from the I that hears and just connect with hearing. Instead of thinking with the mind, think through the mind as if you were using a computer which is running a program. The thinking is like the software of the program of the computer. Just connect with thinking. When you do this, you will see that all there is arising is just seeing, hearing, thinking, smelling, with no one doing it. The identification is an extra thing that the mind adds to the experience. We want to see through that.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.